This week on Happy, Sad, Confused, Jay Baruchel on being a proud Canadian making his directing debut and the Justice League movie that got away. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused, my podcast. Say hi, Sammy.
Hi, Sammy.
No, that's too literal. Ugh.
I take direction very well.
Sammy just got back from the VMAs doing stellar work on the carpet and backstage and all sorts of nooks and crannies of the VMAs.
What was your favorite part of the VMAs?
I watched it all.
What was your favorite performance?
Rod Stewart?
Yes. Honestly, you could be joking, but it's real.
He was there, I remember.
Rod Stewart performed. Made everyone feel really comfortable and happy.
Yeah, exactly. I felt uncomfortable on my couch in New York.
Yeah, it was really great.
So, yes. So, welcome back to New York, Sammy.
Thank you so much. It's good to be back.
You're a shell of a woman now.
It's really depressing.
But you were a shell of a woman already.
Yeah, it's just a little worse now.
I've been here holding the fort down, and apologies again for a little bit of a break, but the good news is that I was just telling Sammy about some of the upcoming guests we've got.
You guys are going to freak out.
We've got a lot of people coming the next few weeks. And we're also not even going to observe the normal kind of like weekly thing. You're going to get a couple of folks at a time, one or two episodes a week, at least the next couple of weeks. So a lot of cool guests, some returning guests.
Be ready for anything.
You will be pleased.
There will be blood.
There will be guests. And this week's guest, hopefully you guys will be pleased with. He is Jay Baruchel, who of course you know from many great films. Undeclared was his first big TV show that kind of broke him out. This Is the End, Sorcerer's Apprentice. What else? He's been in a lot of weird, like, kind of random stuff.
This Is the End is the big one for me. And, like, Knocked Up, too.
Of course, Knocked Up. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're welcome.
But we also talk about a film that has kind of gained cult status in recent years, a film called Goon that I believe he co-wrote it and he starred in it a few years back. It starred Sean William Scott, and it's about kind of like an enforcer, like not the smartest guy, but like an enforcer on a hockey team. And it's a really sweet kind of Rocky-ish story that I was really taken with when I saw it a few years back. I think I saw it on VOD, and I was just kind of like shocked by, not that I wasn't expecting it to be good, but I'd heard some good buzz about it, and Sean William Scott's great in it, and Liev Schreiber was great in it, and Jay's good in it as well. And now in the sequel, Jay has assumed the directing duties as well. He's also in the film, of course, but this is his big feature directing debut.
I was going to say, is this his first?
Yeah. So it's called Goon, Last of the Enforcers. It's out this Friday in theaters, I believe on VOD, et cetera. And you guys should check it out. I'm not even a hockey fan. I've never followed hockey at all, but it's a really good movie, and it's well-directed, and you're going to hear in this conversation the passion that Jay has as a filmmaker. He's always wanted to direct, even before he was an actor, and truly, he is a film geek's geek. He knows his stuff, and as you can imagine, when the two of us got together, we really geeked out on a lot of cool things.
Nerd explosion.
and one thing I do want to mention, a couple things I want to mention. I want to mention the fact that I mentioned kind of the intro, he's a very proud, and it's kind of a beautiful thing, a proud Canadian. He lives in Toronto, and he has chosen to kind of like make his life's work about creating great films and great roles and great art in Canada. You know, he obviously has opportunities in the States and he works in the States here and there, but he's chosen to make his life where he grew up. And, to hear him talk so passionately about it, I think it's kind of contagious, and it's he's carved out a really cool career. He's also now part owner of a big like Canadian comic book company. So he's just like making a cool life for himself there. And Goon is an extension of that. And the one on the film geek side I want to mention to kind of tease you guys that are just tuning in now is he was cast a few years back, actually a long time ago now, in a George Miller film that was going to be called Justice League. I think it was called Justice League Mortal. And it was Armie Hammer was playing Batman. Do you know about this, Sammy? Have you ever told you about this? This is a crazy story. So
I'm like Mad Max George Miller?
Yes.
Same George Miller?
Yeah, so it was before Fury Road, and it was Armie Hammer as Batman.
I love that.
I mean, DJ Catrona, who I met a couple times, very sweet guy. I think he's on From Dusk Till Dawn still on El Rey, who's playing Superman. I forget who was playing Wonder Woman. There was a Wonder Woman. Theresa Palmer was playing a bad guy. And Jay Baruchel was playing the bad guy, Maxwell Lord. And there have been many stories about this production. It's fascinating.
So what happened?
Basically, the plug was pulled by the studio like right before it went. They were all in Australia. They had done costumes. They'd done read-throughs. They were rehearsing.
And then they were like, eh, never mind.
Basically.
Ooh.
So there's an extended conversation in this interview, more than, frankly, I've ever heard myself about what that film was going to be. So I think if you're a superhero fan and if you're a fan of George Miller like myself, stay tuned for that, because that is, I think, a special part of this conversation. And I was certainly geeking out on what that project would have been. It's one of the great, like, unrealized film projects of all time. So yeah, come for Goon, but stay for Justice League talk.
Yeah.
And that's about it. Like I said, there's going to be another few podcasts coming up in the next couple weeks that you guys should keep a lookout for. Sammy and I are going to be headed to the Toronto Film Festival.
TIFF.
TIFF, as they say.
TIFF, and as the industries.
Did I ever tell you how Kristen Stewart made fun of me when I called it TIFF?
No. What happened?
So a few years back, and I was interviewing Kristen. We were sitting down to chat. And I think, like, my first, like, I don't even know if it was on camera. It might have been on camera. I was like,
I hope it's on camera.
I was like, how's your TIFF going? And she looked at me and she was like, TIFF?
It's like, sounds like you asked her something dirty. Like, how's your TIFF?
Is that what you call it? And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I wasn't trying to sound smart. I thought that's what people called it.
No, that's what George Miller calls it.
It's the Toronto International Film Festival, TIFF.
Oh. Fuck you, Kristen Stewart.
No, it's all good. It's all good. So yes, if you see Kristen Stewart, ask her how her TIFF is going.
She'll be enraged.
She will just slap you.
She'll punch you in the face. No. Yeah.
So, anyway, I'm looking forward to that. It's always one of my favorite festivals, and a lot more good stuff. We're going to also do a sketch next week that I know you're very excited about.
Everyone's going to freak out, including me.
Right, more to come on all of that. Enough jibber-jabbering. Let's hear from Jay Baruchel, and remember to check out Goon, Last of the Enforcers, out September 1st. I was saying to your publicist, actually, surprisingly, despite being at MTV for 30,000 years, I don't think we've talked, or if we have, only a couple times. So it's a real pleasure to see you today.
Likewise, man. Thank you for having me.
I'm a big fan of your work.
Oh,
and
thanks.
We're going to talk about a lot of things. Most importantly, everybody needs to check out Goon, Last of the Enforcers. I'm honestly a big fan of this, and I was
awesome.
I was a huge fan of Goon, like, what,
five years ago.
And it was one of those things where, like, I saw it on, like, a VOD or something,
yeah,
to be
exactly.
honest.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is so charming, so winning,
oh, cool.
filled with a great ensemble, and I'm so pleased that it's done so well for you too.
Thanks,
to
man.
A sequel.
Yeah, thank you. It's so are we. And yeah, we're just these movies mean a lot to everyone involved, and I think a testament to that is, like, how many of the people from the first one we were able to get back, and it was just like, it's not always like that. Sometimes you're on a set and everyone's just trying to do their best, and other times you're on a set and everyone has a sort of unity of vision, and we all kind of, there's something in the water, and you can just kind of sense that we all get what this could be and how cool this could be. And the first Goon was one of those. And yeah, it took us a minute because we wanted to do it right.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't rush this into production to try to, you know, keep the party going. You know, it was like, we had stories that and stuff that we wanted to tell. We just wanted to make sure we could do it in the best way possible and with the requisite means to do to tell the story we needed to tell.
Well, and I was frankly heartened when I finally, you know, got the chance to see the new one, in that, like, you do have basically the band back together, and you have, you know, Liev, who, like, I mean, if, you know, he's, for a decade, he's had an amazing career, 20 years. And
no,
it's like,
kidding.
Oh, is he going to be in one scene? No, he's like a major.
Yeah. And he's got a heavy lifting to do in our flick.
Yeah. And then you add someone like, I mean, I'm sure you're now a big fan as I am of Wyatt.
Yeah.
Who seems like.
Wyatt's amazing. And I'm, like, so proud. Because this is, like, his, I think it's the biggest, one of the biggest parts he's played yet.
Yeah.
And not only that, it's also a million miles away from, if people know him, what they know him for,
right.
Which is usually sort of goofy stoner in, you know, and like in the Linklater movie,
sure.
and all that stuff. But there's a hell of an actor in there.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's down to a bunch of things, not the least of which is his pedigree. You know, he grew up,
Russell, of course,
grew up in the right house.
Yeah.
And having worked with his dad and knowing his dad, you know, I've, like, worked with now two generations of Russell men, and I can see if you can, work with either of them. Yeah. They are so hardworking and easy to be around and just get it. And I hate using terms like just get it, but they just do kind of. And it was super cool that, like, the night before I was meant to Skype with Wyatt to convince him to do the movie, Kurt called me tipsy from New Orleans, telling me that his son called to ask him for advice and he never does, and that he was thinking about doing this Goon too. And Kurt said he cut him off right there and said, listen, I'm biased. Yeah, I just want you to know. He goes, I love Jay Baruchel. I don't know about the first movie, but I know that this one's going to be better because he's directing it. You got to do it. You got to meet him. You'll either fall in love with him or not. He goes, and I'm just looking forward to being proud with you guys at the premiere. So, like, it was like, Kurt Russell's a huge part of casting Wyatt in my movie. It's pretty cool.
That's amazing. One of the great pleasures of this podcast is having, like, the people that you grew up with, and Kurt was in here like a year
ago. Oh, amazing. Amazing.
Like, oh, my God. Yeah. To, like, talk to, you know,
Snake Plissken.
Trouble Snake Plissken. There's so many. It was, yeah. Just, and he's everything you want him to
he be. Is, and he loves chatting it up, and he loves telling stories. Like, some guys, I've, you know, 20 plus years I've been acting, and some of the old guys and girls don't love talking about some stuff. And some stuff is of, like, some stuff that you care about is irrelevant to them. Right. You know, like, I've many times, you know, eaten crow for going out on a limb to give somebody love and having them, like, diminish it in a second.
I totally know what you're saying.
And it's,
I mean, I'll call it out. I remember, this isn't, like, saying anything bad about a person, but I remember talking to Gary Oldman,
yeah,
like, I
yeah,
revere,
yeah,
and, like, mentioning Fifth Element to, yeah, him, and him being like, oh.
So for me, it was Cronenberg. I got to work with Cronenberg, and I just told him, I was like, I want to hear about Videodrome, man. And, yeah, and his answer was, that's old shit. And that was the end of the conversation about Videodrome. I was like, yeah, fair. But Kurt loves to tell stories and loves, and he really, he knows how cool it is, the life he's had. And he knows that the reason he's had a cool life is because people love his movies. And so he's like, when he meets someone, especially someone our age who, you know, were kids growing up with his movies, it's a really big deal for him. And so that was the coolest by far.
Yeah, he had no trouble dropping into, like, Jack Burton quotes. Like,
right?
My brain just melted.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
I know that, like, directing, because I've been following your career and reading up on some of the stuff you've been talking about lately in support of this film, that directing is not something you've just come to lightly. This, if anything, this was the thing you actually wanted to do before acting.
Honestly, man, and I hate, and I always worry when I say that the people infer that I, like, am disrespectful to acting or don't, but no, it's just, acting has been very good to me and to my family, and I've gotten to do some pretty awesome stuff all the same. My dreams have been on hold for 20 plus years.
Yeah.
And, like, 9 was when I knew I wanted to direct. 12 was my first year on set. And even at 12, Mom said to me, you want to go to film school. Being on set's the best film school in the world. So I've been on film school for 20 years. It's not like I have nothing to prove as an actor. I don't have anything I haven't done to me that I need to get out there. I have loads to prove and loads of story inside of me as a director and loads of stories I want to tell. And so acting was always a means to an end. It's not something, like, I loved. And then after being on enough sets, I was like, oh, I think I could maybe do that. Like, right, you know, so I also, I don't know that that's the right reason to be a director, because, and I'm going to get waxed super religious and poetic here, but, like, I think cinema is the greatest art form the world has ever come up with. And I think in the 21st century, there's precious little that's sacred. One of the few things that I see as sacred is the relationship between someone that makes a movie and the audience. And I think that to get to be a director is one of the world's great privileges. And I've worked for directors that I think that was lost on. You know, or whom I think that was lost on,
it was a job.
Yeah, and took it for granted, or didn't seem to, like, have a bunch of burning need to do something. It was sort of, you know, it's fine. It was sort of journeyman, I guess, I suppose. But, like, I'd live in the gutter if it meant I could direct again. Like, that's, like, I'm constantly threatening to sell my house if it helps finance something. Like, I will do whatever it takes. I'll bleed for my shit. So this was a very big deal, obviously.
So what can we talk a little bit about kind of reference points and falling in love with kind of movies as a mm-hmm. kid in terms of like when did you kind of fall in love with the church that is cinema,
mm-hmm, et cetera? Mm-hmm. So the kind of flashpoints of my childhood would be mom and dad not just showing me Monty Python the Holy Grail, but pausing it constantly to explain to me the mechanics of the joke that was just on screen. Literally, mom would like pause at a funny caption or a funny bit of credits, and she'd be like, "This is called dry humor." And you see how he referenced the dancing mule earlier? That's as a callback. And they would literally, like, it was a very proactive kind of film and comedy education. And then it was the first tape dad bought me for my 9th birthday. I think it was a Ferris Bueller's Day Off on VHS. And my parents, to their credit, kept getting me movies. I kept buying movies. And they kept getting me books about movies. Like, when I was a kid, there weren't a ton of dinosaur books in my room. It was all either film critiques, or I'd get the like in-house guide that a video store has of like what every all inventory available right now.
Right.
So I would just spend hours in my room reading synopses, reading reviews, committing to memory plots and directors and actors and movies I've never seen. And I just memorize all of them. And then on top of that, every Friday night and Saturday night, Dad would rent a minimum of one, usually two movies. And if I woke up the next day, the next morning, and the tape was still in the machine, it meant I was allowed to watch it. And as I was always up before my folks. If it was back in his case, it meant it was too racy. But what this translated to is every weekend for most of my childhood, 2 to 4 movies, no matter what. Wow. No matter what. And like I said, I get up early before my folks, so it was me and the movie. And I haven't stopped collecting. I'm still the putz that buys hard copies. I buy Blu-rays. Like, it's a point of pride that my house, I've got, like, 5 bookshelves filled with DVDs and Blu-rays. Nice. And I still buy them. And I like that collection.
How are they organized?
Alphabet.
Okay. Yeah. Not genre, not director.
Not yet. I had to get them up there first.
Right. No, that's a huge
accomplishment. It was a 2-day, 3 or 4 person job. So yeah, my friends earned brownie points those days.
So what was Canadian cinema for mm-hmm. you growing up.
Yeah.
Did that mean something? You mentioned Cronenberg. Yeah. Obviously, he's what comes to the top of the list. But, like, what did that mean to you growing up?
He was my hero and still is. And especially as I got to be, like, a teenager and became a big Fangoria kid and knowing that, like, he wasn't just a guy. He was the guy. Like, every horror director wishes they were David Cronenberg.
Yeah.
Like, he's the horror director that gets, like, fancy person cred.
Right.
And it was always a point of pride to me that, like, not just a horror director, but the world's best horror director not only is Canadian, but made all his films in Canada and still lives in Canada. And that was such a inspiration because we grow up seeing all of our best kind of exported super early. The only time I'd see Canadian celebrities or anything like in Canada was when work dried up for them elsewhere. And then they'd come home because the CBC is the only place that would hire them. And it like leaves a really sour taste in your mouth.
Sure.
And that coupled with never going to the cinema and seeing a movie that takes place where you're from has a strange cultural repercussion. And I think like Americans and Brits take it for granted that you go to your cinema and your cinema is a reflection of your country and your culture. Well, it's not like that in Canada. All right, we go to our cinema and it's all foreign films. American, but that's still foreign. That's not ours. So I knew that I was going to give my life to Canadian cinema for better or worse at about 15, 16. Mm-hmm. And how I'd reasoned it out of my head, because I was still a child actor at that point, was like, work will probably dry up for me around 18, 19. If I've saved any money, I'll go to film school. When I'm done film school, if I have anything left, I will live off of that. If I don't, I'll just get a job, hopefully at a video store was the goal. And then I'll just write straight to videos and try and get them made. Cause there wasn't, I'm a video kid. So I love going to the movie theater. Of course I do. And some of my greatest memories are in the movie theater, but most aren't. Most are at home.
Yeah.
And we didn't discern. We would rent whatever looked cool. And there's a, you know, and I, like I talked to Rogan about this, about how there's all these movies that we watched when we were kids in Canada that we didn't realize never came out in theaters. They were just like cool looking stuff on the shelf that we rented. And so I got exposed to all sorts of stuff, and I never thought that it was like beneath somebody to make a straight to video. Like I was like, if I make movies, if I get to write and direct a movie and someone funds it, that's all there is. I don't care about the size of the audience. That's neither here nor there. I just want to be able to make movies. So that was the goal. That was the mission I was on. And then at 18, I got hired in the States on Undeclared. And I'm not, dude, please, I am not complaining about the American career I've had since then. But all the same, I thought I'd be getting into this at 18, 19, 20, and I'm now 35. So it's like, and you know, because also when you're a film nerd, you have stupid mile markers that you want to hit. Like, you're aware of how old Branagh was when he did Henry V, sure, or Orson Welles.
Screw it up for everybody.
Yes, basically. They fucking do, man. And so I was like, the goal was to get, if I can't get Orson's number, 23 or 24, I want to get Branagh 26. But I miss both. But it's not like I wasn't doing anything else cool. So, you know. But.
Totally. I mean, it's funny. Branagh comes up on this podcast all the time because I was obsessed with him as a kid, partially because of what he was doing, but also because he was like, yeah, he was so young. He was relatable in a way, even though if he was doing Henry V was a little beyond my small brain at the time.
Right.
It was still like, oh God, this guy's like
he adapted Shakespeare.
I made it cool and like
directed
action, like an action film
and
in a way.
Starred in it, and he was 26. Yeah. Like those people spoil it for the rest of us. It's you know there'll always be somebody who did it earlier.
So, and backtracking, even before Undeclared, I know fellow guest of this podcast, Alicia Cuthbert, have a similarity in that your kind of big break was
Popular Mechanics.
Exactly, which I know is even was a big thing for you still in Canada.
Yes, it is. It's still the thing that I think her and I get recognized for the most. And I'm sure they're when people do it, they're well aware that we've had careers after, sure. But they think they're being quite clever.
At the time, was that kind of like, were you self-aware enough to know, like, this is not what I want to do, but hey, it's kind of cool. Like
it was definitely, I knew it wasn't what I wanted to do. I didn't enjoy doing that show a ton because acting is what you just described of like, it's not what I want to do, but it's cool.
Right.
Hosting is not, you know, and you know, think about how shitty you feel about yourself when you're 15 and yeah, and
you're in a whole nother like
oh fucking hell. And I was like, I didn't get my growth spurt till I was 17, so I was like an undersized kid at 15 with all the hormones that any 15-year-old has. And yet I was like doing this goofy thing. Like I'll never forget. It's like this fucking great. Like this sums up how I feel about Popular Mechanics as best I can. There's two events. One was going to Bristol, Connecticut at 5 in the morning to go to the Otis elevator testing facility to pretend that I was interested in how elevators are tested. So it's just not interesting. It just isn't. And then number two is we were doing the beginning, middle, and end, like our talkie bits for our roller coaster amusement park episode. And so we were at La Ronde, the amusement park in Montreal. But it was open. It was like a summer day, and it was open. And there's all these people my age out having teenage lives and falling in love. And I was just like, hi, guys. So we're going to talk about centrifugal force. And I remember posting up, in their infinite wisdom, they decided the best place for me to do these throws was at the foot, at the entrance of the biggest roller coaster at La Ronde, Le Monstre, the Monster. And I will never forget these three fucking asshole Anglo kids. So Montreal, you're Anglo, you're Franco. And these are Anglos. These are in my side of the city. And these fucking three asshole kids. There's an idiot, idiot's girlfriend, and idiot's friend. And I see them pointing, and they're whispering, they're making fun, and she's got his arm around him, and they're laughing at my expense, and I'm just like, this is a fate worse than, I know I'm being paid, it doesn't change it, and then they start, and they're like,
the psychological repercussions of this will last.
And they go, all right, action, Jay, and as they say, action, Jay, and I start doing my throw, the roller coaster starts to go up, and idiot's friend, this ginger in a backwards baseball cap, just goes, faggot, and I was like, so back to centrifugal force, and hopefully I don't kill myself today.
Yeah.
So it was, but that being said, I did get to see some cool shit. I got to spend three nights on the USS Eisenhower aircraft carrier in the U.S. Navy. That was pretty cool. I got to spend a day on a Trident submarine at dock, but that was still quite neat. I got to spend a day behind the scenes working with all the guys at the Universal Studios Stunt Spectacular. So and I got to there on our special effects episode. I got to hang out with these prosthetic makeup artists and see all of that stuff, and like I said, I was a Fango kid, so that was real cool. So there was some cool shit, but more often than not, it was just like, you know, because also when you're a kid, when you're 15, do you like 15-year-old stuff? No. You like 20, 30-year-old facing stuff. And so no 15-year-old wants to be hosting a kid's show. You know, like I'm saying, yeah.
Do you still get offered hosting things? Because people still see that at the beginning of the resume?
I do. I don't enjoy it. Yeah. I've hosted... one Just for Last Gala, okay. And then I hosted one award show. There's in Canada, we have this thing called the Polaris Prize, which is once a year, top music critics in Canada vote the best record, and they give it $30,000, whoever it is. And that can be a first timer, that can be Drake, literally.
Nice.
And I hosted that one night. That was a fate worse than death.
Look at that. So unprofessional.
Please. That was a fate worse than death because it was just a room full of hipsters that had no idea who I was, and they didn't seem to find my sense of humor very funny. I wrote some... Me and Jacob Tierney wrote some wicked fucking jokes for that thing.
Wrong audience. Know your audience. The first rule of hosting.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
So you mentioned Undeclared, which you know, set your career on a different path, a good path for mm-hmm. a while. Did it feel like... I mean, you talk about those were the years that spawned kind of like the biggest chunk of living in the States, right?
Definitely.
So at the time, I mean, you were resolute, it sounds like, from the beginning. Like, this, I'm going to end up back in Canada.
Yeah.
That's who I am. Yeah. I want to produce things that reflect my upbringing, et cetera.
For better or worse.
That being said, especially in those first couple of years, I would think that's when the most exciting first opportunity started to come.
Yep.
Was there any kind of, like, wrestling with that?
No, never. No, I'd argue about it with friends of mine. Very interesting, I think, philosophical debate that friends of mine in the States or from Canada, some of whom are far more famous than I am, before any of us could get hired, when we were all just like stoners with time to spare in LA, I was always the movie nerd. We all love movies, but I always could tell everybody who the director was, right, and that this was Andrew Davis's third film and all this stuff. And
you know the work of Andrew Davis beyond just The Fugitive, then you know some shit.
That's exactly right, man. Above the Law, I think is number three for him. No, actually, it's one of the Chuck Norris ones. Anyway, but we'd have this big philosophical debate about, like, what would you rather have? A smaller soapbox but more control and a degree of patriotism or civic duty behind it? Or a larger soapbox with less control, right, and nothing to do with your country? You know, and the thinking, I was always firmly entrenched on the other side, the small side. The thinking on the large side was that if you get to a point, if you can navigate and survive the studio system in LA and get to the top of it, you no longer have to suffer those notes and all that stuff,
right,
which, by the way, is horseshit, number one, because what happens is, simply by virtue of having gone through it so many times, maybe it's born of self-defense, you start chess moving those notes.
You've internalized it all. It's happening anyway.
You pre-censor.
You've become the monster.
You censor before you have to.
Yeah.
You just assume it's not worth it. There's no way they're going to go for this. There's no way they're going to go for that. That's not this. That's not that. And I just find that not for me. And for me, you know, I'm a Hollywood film fan. I love a bunch of independent films, but I'm not like some Dogma 95 guy. Like I love the same movies that we're all talking about here. But I want to create a my country, and it sounds like insane but my country's small and a baby, you know, like mine is 30 million, 1/10 the population of this country. And who knows if there is a Canada in 100 years. And we are constantly, we were fighting to define our own culture against Great Britain. And then eventually, and then that shifted to finding to define our own culture against the United States.
Yeah.
And I know that, let's say I And by the way, like, I, if you can get a movie made in the States, you should be so fucking lucky, you know, and that would be lovely, but I would be just another guy and it would be a movie. If I can make movies back home and I live there and I'm from there and I can get butts in the seats, it means something. And there's, and our tapestry, our sort of shared collective cultural tapestry in Canada is a pretty thin little rug. Mm. It's there, but it's thin. I've already added to it with the first Goon, you know, and I can't ever hope to do something like that here, right? And also, my mom's family are all soldiers and cops, and I never joined the army, and I never served the way that I've always thought I should. And so there's
a way to actually,
at least a portion of it, yeah.
Were you ever able to? Have you ever discussed any of this with someone like Cronenberg, who has committed, as you say, his life to kind of a...
I told him that he was like a source of inspiration for sure.
But it's not just about what he's done, it's
how he's done it and the way he's done it, and that the two weren't mutually exclusive for him, that like he wanted his kids to have normal lives, and he also just liked where he lived, I think, you know. And if you're Cronenberg, you get people to come to Toronto. If you're Fellini, you get people to come to Rome. If you're Peter Jackson, you'll go to Auckland or Wellington. You know, like, you can do it. It's there to be done. And I just think that people take the convenient path of least resistance more often than not.
I'm headed to Toronto for a film festival TIFF, very soon. I've been going for almost a decade.
Oh, awesome.
And I always love it. You must have a different perspective.
Sure. I've never seen, I don't think I've ever seen a movie at, I've seen one movie at TIFF that I wasn't a part of.
Okay.
I saw The Witch last year or 2 years ago.
2 years ago, probably, yeah.
And, I only, my intro to TIFF was always through bringing a movie that I was in or something. And now that I live there, I sort of stay clear of downtown while it's happening if I can.
Sure.
But what I love about it is that I think it's already, if it hasn't, it's about to replace Cannes in terms of its import and its weight. And because it's over here and because it's open to the fucking public.
Yep.
That's what sets it apart to me. And, you know, all that it's, I think TIFF is missing really is a competition. A true competition a la Cannes. Once, because they have juries, they do all that stuff, they give out awards, but they don't have, like, nothing's in competition. If Toronto gets a competition, that's it. And what I love is that it's just so much more humble. It's for everyone, and yet still the biggest stars in the world come. And it's ours, and it's like, it's anything that gets the world to come to Canada is a big deal for me.
So let's talk. I know we've been jumping around, but we should talk more specifically about Goon and its sequel that's about to come out here in the States. I mean, there's a lot that I love about both of these films.
Awesome.
I mean, one thing that I'm struck both times by Sean William Scott's performance.
He's amazing.
He's truly great. Yep. He's got in, like,
not just good in comparison to how you think he is. No. He's just good. Period.
No, and it sucks that he hasn't, I don't know, gotten opportunities in recent years or what. I don't know where he's at in his personal life.
I think it's like I think he got sick of doing riffs on Stifler.
Yeah.
And but he's a huge movie nerd. Sean really is. And like when Sean and I text, it's literally about like 4 years ago, it's like, hey, did you see Elite Squad? Yeah, did you see Elite Squad number 2? Like, Sean sees everything.
Wow.
He's that guy. He's like me. He goes to Amoeba, buys it all, sees it all, rents it all. Like, he really loves movies. He really, really does. And I think he got, a bit sort of tired or even stung that he loves movies so much and he doesn't get to be a part of the types of movies he'd like to be in, you know, with the exception of like Southland Tales, which even though it's like a weird, crazy flick, at least it's something.
It's going for something.
It's going for something. And I'm so proud that our movie gets to show the world what he has inside him.
Because it's a tough role to pull
it is,
off.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he's basically...
If he didn't say yes, we'd have no replacement. Like, there probably wouldn't be a movie.
Right. Because, I mean, it's kind of a little bit of kind of the Rocky thing in that, like, he's not a bright guy.
No. He's like a cross between, like, Forrest Gump and Superman.
Right.
You know, like and Chauncey Gardner a little bit, I guess, too. Like, he belongs to no era, Doug. And what Sean has to do in this movie, he has to do the normal number one stuff of carrying the movie on his shoulders. He's got to be funny when we need him to be funny. He's got to be hard as shit when we need him to be hard as shit. And he's got to be lovable and likable and heartbreaking in those moments, too. Now, those three things are a bit kind of contradictory, mutually exclusive-ish. How do you have a guy? How do you have a guy be this pussycat and have the audience buy that he can, like, brain somebody?
Right.
And you do with him. And it's down to how smart and honest he is, and that he is just like Big Boy from Minnesota.
I'm not a hockey fan. I never have.
Right.
I've never gone to a hockey match in my life.
Right.
And so again, I think that speaks well to what you guys have accomplished.
Oh yeah, thank you. That's huge. Yeah.
Because I would think when you made both of these films and you've directed the second one, you wrote and starred in the first one, of course. You tell me, like, who were you making it for?
Yeah.
Were you thinking about sort of like, I want this to be this era's Slapshot, et cetera? Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we thought, we always knew best case scenario it becomes our generation Slapshot. And that's in spite of, or despite all of us like liking it, but not loving it the way our dads did.
Right.
Like, we all grew up with dads who are firmly entrenched in the cult of Slapshot. And, like, don't get me wrong, Slapshot makes me laugh super hard in most of it. But I don't, it just doesn't mean as much to me as it does to guys my dad's age. Sure. And all that stuff. No, who, this is who we wanted to make the movie for. I don't want anyone who doesn't fall into this category to feel alienated or that you're not welcome. We want everyone who likes our movie to like our movie. All are welcome. But at the same time, when you set out to make something for everyone, you will make something for no one. So you've got to make something for somebody. And so we made
the specificity that makes it resonate.
And that's what makes it universal.
Yeah.
And we made it for, I've been saying, we didn't do it for guys in Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal. We did it for guys in Halifax and Winnipeg and Calgary. It's for lower middle class, regular Canadians, taxpayers who go to the cinema all the time, go to the Cineplex, love a big blockbuster, love a good entertaining comedy, and never get to see one about them. And so we wanted to give them a movie that looks just as slick and sexy and upmarket and big as the big American flick that costs four times as much as us next door.
Yeah.
We want, you know, and we there's an aesthetic hump that I think, and this doesn't apply to Egoyan or Cronenberg, but there's like an aesthetic hump that a lot of, and especially mainstream kind of Canadian cinema, as thin as it is, had to get past. And I think we did that with the first Goon. I don't think like it looks like a tax shelter movie, and so we went even further in that down that road in number two. Like, there's only two handheld shots in all of Last of the Enforcers, and they're meant to be recreating news footage. I had a very, very specific instinct for the aesthetic of this movie. I was like, it has to be classicist. I want all of my favorite directors, all of the Easy Riders, Raging Bulls guys, they're all children of David Lean,
right?
Right. It's all David Lean, and their movies mean the most to me, and David Lean's movies mean a great deal to me. And I was like, this is the tradition I grew up in. And I got really mad at this aesthetic that saturated TV and cinema in the last 10 years, where it's like, if you like electronic music, if you like synthesizer music, you know when it sounds like shit. And when it sounds like shit, it's because the guy's just pressing the preset. He's not even coming up with his own sound. He's playing the preset.
Right.
Like J.J. Abrams' famous theme for Lost is a preset sound. And now cameras have that. They come out of the factory broadcast ready. Right, you don't have to endeavor to find your image and to make it beautiful. You can, but you don't need to. And so now everything looks kind of the same. Everything's handheld. And by the way, it makes sense if you're a producer, you just spray everything down, get as much fucking footage hanging there. Oh, but there's no intention, and there's no, you know. That's not what is important to me. I think of Close Encounters. I think of JFK. I think of The Fugitive. You know, I think of Last of the Mohicans. I think of Braveheart. These are all movies done in that old classic tradition.
Yeah.
And I thought, especially considering how sort of foul and coarse and blue collar and rough around the edges our movie is, the more Ben-Hur we make it, the better. And so I kept saying it's a Hoser Puck opera. It's a cross between Trailer Park Boys and Ben-Hur, you know, and that's not two forms I've ever really seen together.
Amazing. Well, you basically just listed like five of my favorite films.
Oh, wicked. In that rant. Terrific.
They're re-releasing Close Encounters, as you probably know.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
I just saw it on the big screen.
Is it a different, like, do they do anything with it?
As you know, there are like a few different versions.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I think it's like the... It's not the one where he goes into the spaceship.
Okay.
So I think it's like the director's cut, uh-huh. not like the uh-huh. extended.
Gotcha.
It looks amazing.
And that's the only movie he ever wrote.
I know. I think he co-wrote. I think he has a co-writing credit on AI, bizarrely.
Oh yeah, he might have. Because he was going over to England with and like staying. He spent a lot of time at his house in England. They developed that thing together for like 2-3 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's worth seeing. It's fascinating.
Awesome.
What was I going to say? So we talked a little bit about the cast. One thing, not to put you on the psychiatrist's couch, but you do direct your ex.
Tell me about it.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Alison Pill, who's obviously a wonderful actor.
Agreed, yeah.
Was in the first Goon as well.
No, it was definitely something for us to figure out, 100%. No,
that's not something that most first-time directors have to reckon with.
No, I don't think they do, and I think it speaks volumes about her and my dysfunctions, or how artsy we are. No, but literally, like, we lived together, we broke up, 3 years went by, I saw her at the table read, and then 2 days later, I'm directing her to give birth. but what's awesome
would you
is
recommend this for other people just sorting out complicated relationships?
I'll say it prepares you for shooting hockey. it makes hockey easy. No, she's an awesome person, and she's an awesome actor and an awesome artist, and I mean that sincerely, and this is what I mean about how dyed in the wool kind of artsy her and I are. Once Jesse, my writing partner, and I realized that we not realized, just owned up to the fact that Doug and Eva would still be together. So if Doug and Eva are still together, that means Eva's in the movie. If Eva's in the movie, it means Allison has to be in the movie, or at least we have to offer it to her. I can understand if she doesn't want to do it, but it's hers to lose. And when we said we want to make another one, do you want to be Eva? Yes. And neither, and it's like we're not like text buddies, we're not acquaintances, we have nothing to fucking do with each other, but we respect each other as artists, and we had a blast on the first film, and we're both huge fans of the first film, and also Allison wouldn't do it if she thought it was shit, and she's like not in the habit of doing people favors, and especially not this my blanky ass. So like it was she saw what we were trying to do, and for me, more often than not, it wasn't my ex on set. I was just spoiled for riches with one of the world's great actresses.
Sure. Yeah. So as a fellow film geek, I want to hit you up on a couple of people you've worked with. Mm-hmm. Infamously, you almost worked with, but you spent some time.
Oh, Miller. Yeah, that's the heartbreaker, buddy.
I know you've talked
that's
about
the heartbreaker. No, I haven't. Not nearly enough.
So I'm obsessed with George Miller. As I'm
you
sure
and me
you
both,
are.
Bud.
I mean,
you and me both.
And that last film he directed was probably my favorite of the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, same here.
Genius.
Same here.
So for context, you were in the other Justice League movie that was going to happen.
You
guys were all in Australia, I think.
Yeah, it was called Justice League Wordle. And it was, written by, they called the Mulroneys. I forget their name, but, it was a writing team. Mm. And it was kind of a riff on the Infinite Crisis storyline. Yeah, I went in. I met with Miller after sending my tape in, and we were in and all of our tapes had to just be any monologue we liked. So I did the like you can't handle the truth thing as found my way of doing it. And I was shooting Tropic Thunder at the time, so I was like in between takes. So I had camo on my face and I was in fatigue, so it worked perfectly. And then I went in for the meeting, and next thing I know, they're like, "Yeah, okay, so they want you in Sydney next week for rehearsal."
Oh my God.
And so that was cool, and to be in a superhero movie. And I was going to get to be the bad guy.
Yeah, you were Maxwell Lord.
I was Maxwell Lord. Now, not your dad's Maxwell.
I was going to say, everything about this film, everybody was younger than you usually had seen them. Yep. The fact that you were playing the villain and you were probably in your late 20s or something.
I was, and like, that specific villain.
Yeah.
You know, because he's not like the Joker. You know, like this, a lot of people no idea who the fuck he is. Yeah, it was going to be me and then Therese Palmer as Talia al Ghul.
Right.
And strange. But what I loved about it, though, was how fucking specific it was and shamelessly, like, they just had a vision. So I get down to Australia and we do this read through, and the Nico, the guy that co-wrote Fury Road with Miller, was there as his dramaturg. And he said, Nico's here. What we're going to do, we're going to do, they picked up the script. They said, this is just paper. This is just a document. We don't care about the document. So we want to remove you from the document. So first table read, anytime you have a line of dialogue to say, don't say your line, say your character's name, the word says, and then the line. So everyone's Batman says, Superman says, Maxwell Lord says. And we did all this really deep Stella Adler acting class type shit. But it was only for about 4 hours a day, and the rest of the time we were in Sydney. But, you know, and it was just like working with one of the greatest at Kennedy Miller at their headquarters. Yeah. And at that point, they had built so much of the movie. They had all the costume design. They had all the previs. They had all of the sort of production design figured out. And so they would take us and walk us through this command center where they had everything, all of the art up. And the aesthetic choices that they were making and the story and character choices they were making are so ballsy, and we won't ever see it.
What do you think it would have like felt like? Can you even like compare it to anything? This is going to go down, already has. It's one of the great unrealized.
Yeah, like Hodorowski's Dune kind of. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's
talk actually about that.
No, it's coming. They're trying to do one. Well, that's the other reason that I was so rooting for Fury Road. In addition to being like Mad Max, like Road Warrior is one of the first films Mom ever showed me. Mm-hmm. But also I knew everyone involved in Fury. It was the same team from Justice League. And the how would it have felt? Imagine Miller doing Snyder. Like, that's the way I could describe it, because it was very tableau, and it was very, very, they were paintings. And yes, like, yeah. And then what the characters were doing had such teeth to it. Like, there's a scene where I brainwash, or Maxwell Lord brainwashes Clark, and all of a sudden, this guy's got Superman as a weapon. But in order, the process for me, because I can always control people's minds and my nose bleeds a little, for me to get into a Kryptonian brain, my pitch was, and we were going to do it, and Miller loved it, was, it's not just a nosebleed. I start bleeding out of every fucking orifice in my head, because it takes that much to get in the Kryptonian brain. And then I do, and I turn him into full red-eye Superman, and then there's this big-ass fight between him and Wonder Woman, where he breaks her fucking wrists and shit. Like, and then I die halfway through the movie, and then my consciousness is uploaded into a fucking mainframe, then I'm an evil computer. The first time you see Wonder Woman, the opening scene on Themyscira, it was just her. It's her on top of a steed. There's a minotaur, and she stood about half a kilometer away from a minotaur. Minotaur's got a battle axe in his hand, and she just rushes him. All the Amazons are there cheering her on, and she just beheads him, gets off her steed, and holds up the minotaur thing, and she doesn't say a goddamn thing. And I was like, that's the Wonder Woman I want to see. You know, it would have been special. And for me, selfishly, personally, like, so while we're there, they start booking houses for all of the Justice League. And they're not asking me. And I said, so are you guys going to find, like, well, we think you're only in 12 scenes. We think you're going to go back and forth. And I'm like, well, A, that's a lot of travel. B, that's a bummer. I'm having fun. And so I said to George, I was like, you know, how long do you want me here? Because I'm only in 12 scenes. So if you want me to just come in and go, that's absolutely fine. I'm happy to be here. And he's like, oh, no, no, no. He goes, I want you here the whole time for two reasons. I want you here, one, because I don't want to break up our team. I want to keep the posse together. You're a company. You're a repertory company. Number two, and this is the heartbreaker, he said, I know you have an interest in cinema, and I want you to be here every day to shadow me like I did with Mel on Thunderdome. He literally offered me an apprenticeship. So, like, and I was like, there's no way on earth I'm going to do this without my agents giving me shit for being taken off the market as an actor. I was wrong, because everybody knows who Miller is. Yeah. And so when I told my agent at the CAA that I'd been offered an apprentice, he's like, oh, you take that fucking opportunity. Get
ultimate grad school.
Get there. Pay for yourself to be there. Yeah. No. So, and then it was like, I went home on December 23rd, January 7th, we'll be back in Sydney. January 6th, I got the call, it's not happening. DJ Catrona, my buddy who's going to play Superman, right, who's on the From Dusk Till Dawn TV show, he had it far worse. He didn't get the call the day before. He was standing with his luggage in front of his place in L.A. The town car was pulling up as he got the phone call, "You're not going." And the driver said, "I'm here to take you to the airport." And he said, "No, I'm not." He's like, "I'm pretty sure I am." He's like, "Buddy, I just got the call. Please, my heart's broken. I'm going back inside." Literally had his bag packed. Yeah. And he had been there. I was only in Sydney for two weeks. He had been there. Him and Army Hammer had each been there for like 2 or 3 months at that point, training to be Batman and Superman. Yeah.
If the actual doc doesn't happen, I want to do like a 10-part podcast.
Oh, fucking the making of, buddy, the story and the crazy anecdotes, and I'll, you know, maybe it'll come up why we referred to ourselves as Hobo League of Australia and all this. Like, we had a good time.
Oh my god. One other film I can't let you go without mentioning is Tropic Thunder.
Which, that's a good flick.
I mean, it's more than a good flick. It's an amazing film. You're kind of like the straight guy in that story, which is, again, a tough role. And I would imagine tough to kind of like keep it together opposite one of like the great comedic performances ever, that Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, him and Jack Black. Sure. Like, and Stiller's killing it, too. And it was very hard to keep a straight face. But I love being the straight guy. So what I did, This Is the End. It's what I did in Man Seeking Woman too. Yeah. I set everyone else up so they can drive the puck to the net, and I like it. And it is no movie or story worthwhile functions without that character.
Yeah.
The audience needs to see themselves in somebody. That being said, I was corpsing constantly, and but what was so cool was that it was not just that. It scratched three itches. The shooting of Tropic Thunder was, I got to be around, in my opinion, like the funniest people on earth, and I would go so far as to say I think that that's Black's best work and Downey's best work. That would be enough. Also, as like a red-blooded Canadian that grew up loving G.I. Joe and action movies and playing cops and robbers, getting to put on fatigues and fire an M16 every day for 6 months was the greatest. And then the film nerd in me was watching, you know, one of the last great old-school style practical films.
Yeah.
You know, like our big explosion that in the first 10 minutes of the movie. That's real. That's 2,200 liters of fluid. Our big battle scene is real. That's two actual Huey helicopters, 50 stunt performers, another 50 extras, a dozen cast or two dozen cast. It's all real and shot by John Toll.
Right, I was going to say, I remember that it was...
There's a reason it looks as fucking good as it does, because the guy shot Legends of the Fall and Braveheart and The Thin Red Line. And we shot it on like film and like.
Well, it's exactly what you were saying about your approach to your new film.
That's right.
Which is that Stiller did not approach it like as a lazy comedy.
It was not a comedy.
As Apocalypse Now.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And to that end, he gets John Toll, and you know, and it has this Stiller knew that like Scream, it has to function as the thing it's making fun of.
Right.
You know, it was like, it was so funny. Like Nolte on set said, this will be Strange Love. McBride on set said, I think this is like Scream. And I think it's kind of a fusion of the two.
Right.
Yeah.
I should let you go soon. We could talk forever about a thousand
things.
Yeah,
same here, bud.
But just to mention a couple other things, I'm excited for you're also on the comic book side.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
Your
Chapter House.
Yeah, just give me a sense of what's on tap for you and what your involvement in this. I'm just curious.
So I am, I'm an investor, a part owner of the company. I own 20% of Chapter House Comics out of Toronto. In addition to that, I'm also the chief creative officer. And so that is a pretty far-reaching purview that everything from does that cape look awesome to does that font work to world building and mapping out arcs and how can we get this big-ass bad guy to be an event for all of our characters. And I just the sort of mission statement of Chapter House dovetailed with my mission in cinema and television, which was giving Canadian kids stories about them.
Right.
And Canadian comics is such its own strange, weird history where it flares up and disappears and flares up and disappears. And the first era, what's referred to as the Canadian whites, all these black and white things that were printed, was during World War II when there was a paper quota. And so no comic books were leaving the States. So all these Canadian kids had no comics all of a sudden for 5 years. Necessity being the mother of of invention, all of a sudden we have the first sort of run of truly Canadian comics. World War II ends, we disappear, and all the American comics come back. In the 70s, you have Captain Canuck. You have Richard Comley in his house, drawing in pencil crayon, printing it himself, gets this book on shelves, and in spite of the fact that it was an independently published comic that ran for 3 years first, disappeared, came back for a year in the 90s, disappeared, and then Fatty Hakim, my business partner, guy who started Chapter House, he said, like, Canuck needs to be done properly. In spite of the fact that it's an indie comic that only ran for 2 years the original time, and in spite of the fact that it's always relegated to the back of every comic book shop in Canada, every single guy my age knows who he is. Jason Eisner was like, I have Canuck number one. Like, we all know Canuck. Mm-hmm. He's just in a street fight for real estate and shelf space against Batman and Superman and Spider-Man. So what we're doing at Chapter House is taking Canuck and all the guys from the 40s and everyone else we can find, all of these earnestly Canadian homegrown legacy characters from our past, rebooting all of them under one shared universe. And really, it's about whether or not the comics are awesome, and they are, because most of our artists and writers earn their trade, apply their trade to Marvel and DC and happen to be living in Toronto.
Right.
And they're all patriots as well. And so we all see what this can be and how we can have a dope comic that happens to take place where we live. And it's a pretty special thing. And we just want to give Canadian kids comics where they can see themselves.
Well, it sounds like you're doing everything that like you love, and then it's personal to you, and that's great. I'm hoping this. I know you have a horror film that you want to direct.
Yeah.
That's hopefully next on tap if you can get it together.
Yeah, yeah, and hopefully there's even an announcement during TIFF.
Amazing.
So we'll see.
All right, I'll look out for you in Toronto. Honestly, come by anytime you want.
Oh man, thank you. This was such a pleasure. That was a lovely, lovely chat. Thank you for the kind words as well, and thanks for having me.
All right, I'll see you soon, man.
We did it.
That was awesome.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.
'Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.